Yes.
Talk Shoe.
Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of Review Less and friend of Jurnov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you download it to your iPod, iPad, or any device or computer and hit play. Today, we have a real interesting show, which I've been trying to do now for a while. It's been in the back of my mind, and it's no surprise to anyone in the industry to say that lawyers are generally not well equipped for technology and the project management needs of electronic discovery. So how can law firms cope with this reality, which is really caused by the training lawyers receive to understand and argue law? There's very little focus at all on technology, and very little nuts and bolts training on electronic discovery, which is our focus here. So, in fact, there are less than 40 law schools currently offering any courses on e-discovery, and while that's been a topic of past and I'm sure future shows, this show is about how lawyers at law firms can utilize lit support departments to help them in their goal to understand both electronic discovery and the tools that they can use. So on today's show, I bring together a panel of litigation support professionals from some very sophisticated firms, and I'm really glad we can do the show. So our first panelist is Jessica Robinson, who's the senior firm-wide manager of eDiscovery Resource Management at Morrison and Forster. This group, the ERM group, operates globally, delivering eDiscovery project management, litigation support, and trial services. In addition to Morrison Forster, Ms. Robinson's an adjunct professor at Georgetown Center for Business and Continuing Education, where she teaches the legal project management course. Prior to joining Morrison Forster, she was the firm-wide manager of practice technology at Crowell & Mooring. Jessica received an MBA in general management from Wake Forest's Babcock Graduate School of Management and her law degree from Wake Forest University School of Law.
Peggy Stolberg, Director of Litigation Technology at Bingham McCutcheon, consults extensively with both attorneys and clients on matters of e-discovery. With 20-plus years in the field, she has been both a witness to and an active participant in the evolution of e-discovery and is known as an authority on its issues and best practices. Peggy oversees a national staff of litigation support professionals and is responsible for creating and implementing litigation and e-discovery technology policies and procedures. Prior to Bingham, she developed and managed litigation support departments at several major law firms, including Wachtell Lipton and Morgan Lewis. Peggy is a member of the Sedona Conference Working Group on Electronic Document Retention and Production, and a VDRM, and is a frequent e-discovery panelist. She is on the faculty of the Practicing Law Institute and was a founding member of the East Coast Association of Litigation Support Managers.
Our third panelist is Greg Jordan, who's the Director of Litigation Support for Arnold & Porter, LLP. Greg consults with legal teams regarding the use of technology to manage document-intensive litigation matters from discovery through trial. With 20 years of experience in the field of litigation support, Greg brings a wealth of knowledge and unique perspective to his position. Prior to this role, Greg was senior project manager at Howery & Simon, where he served as a liaison between legal teams and litigation support staff. At Howery, he conducted design meetings and monitored technology-related activities to ensure cost-effective client-oriented outcomes. Greg received his BA in International Studies from George Mason University. And our last panelist is sitting here on my desk somewhere. You know what? It's not in front of me. I'm sorry, Peggy. I'm going to have to do what I did before. I'm going to have to I'll read in your bio. We'll edit the show, and I'll read it in the bio, and I have experience doing that. So anyway, let's pretend I've read the bio. Okay. I always like to start my programs by asking how you got interested in electronic discovery. So why don't we first start with you, Peggy?
Sure. Well, I started out in the litigation support industry before the name litigation support was coined, and that's as much as I'm going to say about the year. But I implemented one of the early lit support document retrieval systems at a law firm, and then I went on to build a litigation support department to manage our databases and also to handle the in-house scanning that we decided to do of about a million page library of briefs and research. And this was back when imaging was just getting started, especially on-site imaging in law firms. And then when paper was just beginning to be replaced by electronic files in discovery, adapting to these changes seemed to just be a natural for me. And I nudged my lit support department into the, you know, the E direction. And I have to say, in the beginning, it was quite difficult to get buy-in from attorneys to pursue collection and review of ESI because, you know, it was still a matter at that point of, well, I won't ask for email unless the other side asks, et cetera. But, you know, this is one of the things that made it interesting for me because it was the challenge and it was new. And then even when it wasn't so new anymore, it's still a challenge because it's always changing. And so that was my entree into each story.
Great. Jessica, how about yourself?
Well, I fell into litigation support. It was completely by accident. I didn't even know such a thing existed. I came out of law school in 2002, and it was right at the dip after the bubble burst for the dot-com industry. And so it was very difficult to get a job. So I used my law school degree to do contract work, basically. And then I lucked out when my mentor, that's what I'm going to call him now, Paul Hastings, brought me on into litigation support because he thought I'd be very good at it. And I was. And what I got interested in e-discovery right around when the new rules were being proposed. And that's when I realized, wait a minute, this is actually a great a career. This is really interesting stuff, how the law interposes itself onto this technology piece. And with my MBA background, I started using project management rather quickly within my field, within the litigation support department, and it had a really positive impact. So that's how I got into it.
Okay, and Greg, yourself?
Sure. You know, I kind of fell into this about 20-some-odd years ago. I was a paralegal for a firm, and as one of the cases I was working on was going to trial, one of the partners said it would be great to have some kind of visual timeline to be able to show. And I had just purchased my very first Mac computer, and I spent long hours developing on a 7-inch monochrome screen, timeline that was actually used for trial. So that was kind of my interest into kind of doing the litigation support end of it, and then went to another firm where they were doing a lot of imaging in-house using the, I don't know if anybody remembers this, the MARS system, Multiple Access Retrieval System. And then I just kind of fell in more and more into the litigation support end of it and kept with the technology end. And then that's it. So no future in college where I said, this is what I want to do. Just kind of fell into it and pretty lucky I did. And it's been very very interesting, and as everyone says, it changes all the time, so it keeps everyone interested.
Well, remind me to tell you my story of using PowerPoint to build a timeline. I impressed some people with PowerPoint early in my legal career. It's amazing. Simple tools that got you noticed.
Oh, absolutely.
So, anyway, and I think that's comes into this discussion to some extent about, you know, how lawyers are not as tech savvy, but we'll get to that when we get to that question. One of the things I was curious about is you're all at different firms. You know, what are the, sort of the breadths of your responsibilities? What are the types of things you encounter? I don't know if you want to start off with that, Greg, since we started off in the field with timelines. For no
sure.
better reason, I'm throwing the question at you.
No worries at all. I think it's tough to put down exactly because I think it does change all the time, but it's, you know, kind of broadly speaking, we're at a 30,000-foot view. You know, our department, and I think most, you know, litigation support departments are, you know, do do anything and everything that we can to steer, educate, direct, anything dealing with kind of the electronic data or the discovery process. And I think the big part of that is educating along the way and making sure that any particular aspect of whatever is being done, whether it's the collection or the preservation or the review process, you know, you're getting through that training or that education aspect, so everybody remembers it kind of on the next run, or people come to you on the next run and say, oh, you know, those guys really helped me out on that. But it really is kind of encompassing everything. I think the list would be very large for all the specific things that we get on a daily basis, of which, we were chatting earlier about, how we explain what it is that we do. If we're out and about and someone will say, well, you know, what do you do for a living? And then eventually, I think if you're not in this business, it kind of gets met with a blank stare. Ultimately, I generally say, well, I just work in IT. And I think, I think we get those requests as well, which is, can you help with developing a strategy for the preservation and collection of data? And, oh, by the way, can you fix my printer as well?
That was a good answer. Anyone want to add to that?
Sure. This is Peggy. In my department is, we cover all of the lit support functions. We build databases. We handle e-discovery. We handle e-discovery from, the whole range, all the phases of the EDRM. We have people that do consulting before the case starts with our attorneys, with our clients. We have hands-on people who actually do the processing and build the databases and load the data and manage the database. And we also manage vendors when we use vendors for these, for various phases. So we really handle the whole cycle of e-discovery. My role is strategic in nature. I set policies for the department. I keep us ready to adapt to changes in e-discovery. I focus heavily on risk management, policies for project management and process management. Marketing is a big part of what I do, and that's not formal marketing. We have a marketing department, of course, which handles that, but marketing internally to our lawyers is essential because it's really kind of like training. The more that our attorneys know about my department's role in e-discovery, the more they come to us for consultation and for help. So we develop the firm-wide e-discovery training programs. I'm also involved with marketing informally, I would say, to our clients and potential clients by meetings and presentations and things like that. We have two very senior managers in my department who work with me on all the consulting efforts. And all the rest of our folks are hands-on. They are project managers, and they are basically managing their own projects. And so we set goals, we measure, we report, we do strategic planning, budgeting, things like that.
Okay. And I don't know if you have anything to add to that, Jessica. If not, I'll give you the next question.
I do, just a small piece.
Sure.
Just my department is, and I think Peggy did mention that, but we do focus on risk management aspects of e-discovery. So my project managers are trained to pinpoint those and make sure that we're hitting the doing what we're supposed to do to manage risk. That's probably the most important goal. And in my role, I do set the policy, procedure, and workflow for the discovery process firm-wide.
Okay. So, Jessica, what would you say is a typical background, if we were to generalize, of lit support professionals and law firms?
If I'm going to generalize, I mean, it's, lit support usually traditionally came from two areas, from either the IT side or the paralegal side. And it's basically a job that grew out of necessity to figure out solutions to these unique problems presented for discovery. I mean, not even electronic discovery at first, but how to present these large amounts of data. And then it just became a natural, when e-discovery became in play, just became a natural place for litigation support to sit. You know, I have a background in both law and business, and I actually started in litigation support, which is a little bit different, and I think that's part of this new breed, because I am definitely seeing more organizations, and mine included, look for staff purely from lit support background. And, you know, for example, new analysts are being pulled from vendors or directly out of school with some kind of technology background and degree. That's like the new trend.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I'm going to be doing a show soon with Ralph Losey on the certification efforts that are out there, which has gotten a lot of attention, both positive and negative. But it seems there's a hunger for having these types of people. How you find them is I think still more art than science. But lots of paths is what I'm hearing from all of you. Peggy, how integrated are you within your firm? I mean, there's some challenges, I guess, with not being a lawyer when you're a professional in a firm. And is it a, you know, because integration is one of the things that I think is important for this to work real well.
Oh, I agree completely. And it is, it can be difficult, I have to say. Here, my department is quite well integrated with the lawyers at this point. But this has required, and it continues to require, a lot of work. You have to build credibility. You have to develop ways to get exposure within the firm and maintain that on an ongoing basis. One of the messages I brought to my staff when I joined, which was about 4.5 years ago, is number one, always be responsive. Always be responsive to your clients talking to my staff, meaning the attorneys and paralegals. Because if you are responsive, I think that does a huge amount to build credibility, and it really works. Responsiveness, credibility, and doing good work, of course. And it's led to a really good level of integration between my department and our lawyers. It's really important to have ongoing conversations, ongoing training of some kind, ongoing exposure, because our clients, the attorneys and paralegals, need to understand what we do if they're going to come to us and if they're going to treat us as part of the team. So I think we have achieved it, but I do understand the difficulties, and it's something that you can't take for granted. You have to continue to work on it. And I mentioned training programs. I think developing an internal and ongoing e-discovery training program is crucial. So we have done that, and we present panels on various e-discovery topics throughout the firm. And either I or one of my senior managers, plus one or two attorneys, plus others depending on the topics, join the panels. So we get a lot of exposure that way, and that kind of really helps with the integration process, because we're all in this together and we maintain the visibility.
So, and actually, you know, that echoes, you know, I should have mentioned this earlier, that one of the first podcasts I did, I think in the first five, was with a lit support professional at a firm in Philly, Dwayne Morris, and the take of the podcast was why lawyers are challenged by technology, and it was really interesting. So with that in mind, Greg, maybe I've helped. What are your biggest challenges in general? Sorry, I'm not the guest. I'm the moderator. Darn it, I really apologize.
No, I think if I can kind of second the responsiveness aspect of that, I think that has removed, so many of the, of the challenges, because the teams, and this is, over a however many year period, but you put yourself in and you're responsive and you bring good results. And I think, people will want to come back. And I think the challenges are, I think there's a level that You know, litigation support used to mean, a very definable thing when it was imaging. Here's a box of documents. Here's the cost per page to do X, Y, and Z, whatever it is, and you put it in a computer. And now with, you know, all of the various aspects of preservation and collection and do we do this, do we do that, I think the challenges over the last couple of years have been, I think, to a degree, the attorneys letting go a bit and understanding that this isn't necessarily a checklist item. You do this, you do this, you do this, it's all good, it's defensible, everything's fine. And I think, one of the biggest challenges is turning that whole mentality around that, you know, this is, every situation is unique, and you need to bring in, the project managers to work with you on kind of every aspect of this. And there are going to be challenges on all of it, on every part of the EDRM. But I think the biggest change that we, and the biggest trend that we've seen, and I think in all firms and places, that you have to understand kind of to a degree now that it is unique in every situation, and you just always have to get the right people involved and keep them involved. And I think that's, I think there are a zillion different challenges, but if you take that at that 30,000-foot view where the education has helped kind of on the attorney end, understanding that this is not just a very definable checklist item to get through, that there are going to be all kinds of challenges throughout, and you work on everything in a collaborative manner, then I think it all kind of works itself out.
Yeah, if it was easy, you wouldn't have a job.
Right.
You know, which I think is what everyone sort of, all the lawyers I know, a lot of them seem to hope. They, you know, why can't we get it to just do this? And
right.
it, unfortunately, technology on the fly doesn't work that way.
And Carl, I want to also just kind of underline one of the biggest challenges that is, of course, the cost of e-discovery. And, you know, doing quality work while managing the cost. And it, on top of all of the other challenges that we face, that one is really staring us in the face all the time.
Right. I agree. That you know, because a lot of what we do in order to get the stuff in order is these upfront costs that attorneys and clients are scared to pay for, you know, or they because they don't understand it. They're
right.
scared to pay for, and that is one big challenge to get beyond, because making them understand that upfront cost is way less than what it would be if we do this, you know, not upfront, it's a continuous challenge.
Actually, that's one of the things I'm waiting to see if the McDermott case becomes more visible. Is what types of pressures were there to do different things? And because there's always two sides to a story, and we're not going to know. But, you know, it's interesting when, you know, these are usually a little messy in general. So we'll see what happens. So in terms of e-discovery, Jessica, do you see any unique challenges there?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, how people and companies create and store information is changing all the time, changes at a phenomenal rate, actually. And then how we collect and access that information and then the technology we have to do that is also changing. And it totally affects the law and how it's applied. For example, you know, what was reasonably accessible 2 years ago is totally accessible. What was not reasonably accessible 2 years ago is totally accessible now. And another good example is the Stored Communication Act. This is something that's come on as a major legal canon for e-discovery, yet it wasn't an issue a couple years ago. No one looked at that as e-discovery law, and it very much is now because of all the companies that are going to data and cloud app solutions.
Yeah. So
it keeps us relevant because there's no – keeping up with these changes is absolutely a full-time job. It's not something that you can divide your time on.
So with all those changes, Peggy, do you think it's easier to have a large staff to try to tackle this stuff, or does that create complexity too?
Well, I don't think it's a matter of easier. I think it's a matter of having a sufficient staffing to meet the goals and the services that we establish for our individual departments. you know, of course, the more people you have to help with the various, you know, tasks is, of course, a great thing. But if you have a large staff without the proper layers of management in between, then that's not, you know, that doesn't make it easier. That almost makes it more difficult. So, for instance, for me, I couldn't possibly do my job and manage the day-to-day matters and the policies and everything else we do, plus all of our staff. My staff is about 25, and but we have two senior managers between me and the staff. And so I think the key is to have a manager per X number of staff, whatever works, and just make sure that the staff get the attention that they need and deserve and the direction, and have roles for everybody to cover the needs of the department. So, you know, if certainly a large staff is a benefit if you have, you know, huge amounts of work, but stretching people too thin with a staff that's too small can be obviously very detrimental. But I think it's just key to focus on the more people you have to manage, the more management you need as well.
Okay, and Greg, your staff is, you're very hands-on from our previous conversations that we've had.
Right.
How do you approach sort of the staff interplay? Maybe you have a different perspective.
No, I think, I'm involved in a lot, but there are so many cases that we have that we bring. I have a much smaller staff. We have four project managers that basically manage all of the cases, and one technician who works on just the loading and kind of all the technical. If nobody else can figure it out, this is our go-to person. And what we did, because we're pretty lean, we were able to get buy-in and support a number of years ago, where really nothing is done through email necessarily as far as work. We have a kind of a docketing track system that tracks loads that need to come in for databases, that tracks new databases to be created, those folks that need to have rights to that. And we kind of have, to be a kind of a lean and mean shop, we have given had the support to give a fair amount of the authority for asking for things in a particular matter to the firm itself, and through this docketing system, through SharePoint. And what that does is it allows us to be very efficient on the staff, so everybody is involved, but anybody can come in and look at kind of the docket and figure out what needs to be done. Everything is documented, so we kind of know throughout the whole process exactly what task is being done, where we are in this particular project. Whether it's just the consulting approach, we meet weekly to talk about all of that, so everyone's on the same page. But any one of my guys, of which there are a few, can step in at any moment and do that. So we have we have unique challenges on having a small staff, but I think we've built in a lot of efficiencies to be able to get the most bang for our buck.
Yeah, and I should add, some firms don't have any staff, and actually that's one of the reasons. I mean, I don't think there's any one right way to do this. It's just different approaches, and you know, really just trying to figure out. You're all at successful firms. I pick you to do this show because you've all impressed me in our various meetings, and just trying to gain your insights to basically share for some people that don't even have a department and maybe they should be thinking about it. So,
Carl,
so,
I agree completely. And I think, you know, just my experience at previous firms, I never handle everything the same way because you have to adjust to the firm that you're in and the needs of the firm. And there's always something unique. So I agree completely that there is no one size fits all.
So, Jessica, one of the things I've heard from e-discovery lawyers who are on the legal team is running maybe an e-discovery department is oftentimes their biggest complaint is they're not utilized quickly enough. I'm not sure if you have a lit support department if the same types of thing can happen, but I was curious, does it vary between lawyers how well utilized you think lit support people are?
Yes, it does. You know, in several firms that I've been in, it does, and there's many reasons for that. Like, for example, complex litigation tends to use us more. IP cases tend to use us more because the technology and how data is stored is much more complex. But then you struggle with groups like insurance, and maybe that's because of cost. And then you just have the basic reason of we don't know what you do, or didn't know that we could use you, or what your purpose was. That's there as well. And, you know, how we improve it, one is, I mean, there's several things. I talked about a little bit earlier, but education, responsiveness, absolutely key. But then also wins, you know, being successful, actually doing the work and giving a great result that we're able to measure and show that it was a great result and this is why. That tends to help us get a little bit more play because attorney word of mouth in a firm is invaluable with utilization.
Okay. Curious. One of the challenges I'd imagine is to stay up on technology. So I was just curious, going around all three of you, do you typically standardize on technology, and then how do you adapt for change if you are? And let's see, Greg, I think you're next in line for questions.
Yeah, no,
so why don't you start?
Sure. I think for anything internal, I think you absolutely have to standardize, and it's enough of a challenge to standardize on a few platforms and then just work to upgrade those platforms. There's just a massive amount of work in that. So I think you have to standardize on a few things and not support 28 different things internally. If there is a need, again, with every case and every matter being different, if there's a need for a particular, because of the data or because of the way it needs to be reviewed or whatever it may be, if there's a need for an external, external program to do that or external hosting, fantastic. But I think to be efficient and cost effective and to be able to do this in a manner that people are actually used to the particular programs and how they work, I think you absolutely do. So we have four or five programs that we have internal and we support, and if they don't work, then we make suggestions and we'll work with the legal teams to figure what works on the outside.
Yeah, inevitably there's a role for the next vendor based on someone's failure in this field.
Right.
The unfortunate reality. Jessica, how do you tackle standardization?
Yeah, so that absolutely internally we do standardize within the programs that we're using, but we've also tried to tackle standardization externally as well, because from an external standpoint we are technology agnostic. We do a lot of our review and hosted environments, and then we bring in documents for the life of the case internally, and from that standpoint we are really trying to standardize our process and how we deal with the vendors. So regardless of the technology at any level, what we're trying to do is standardize that, so when our attorneys open up a platform, it's still set up the same way, right? And they still, even though it might look different, they're still the same naming for the tags. They're still,
yep.
It's that kind of thing. And we found that we've gained great efficiency doing that.
Yeah, you raise an interesting point. In fact, it's a subject of a future podcast, but the standardization can just be mainly the focus on the process, but actually having on-premises tools versus outsourced tools, there's an underlying issue of what can be supported, because these tools are just getting more and more robust and requiring more and more, technical, they're turning into like foreign sports cars. And there's some unique challenges with that. But that's like a preview for a future show. So anyway, do you have any thoughts, Peggy, on the standardization issue?
I agree with both Jessica and Greg. I mean, we standardize in-house. I think it's really important to do that. And for outsourced work, we standardize as much as we can with regard to the platforms. But we have to be flexible because, sometimes we are directed to use a particular vendor and platform by our clients, and we of course have to be flexible, and we have to I think the focus here is I think as Jessica was saying on the process, so the workflow, even though the tools are different, you know, we try to standardize again as much as possible on the workflow that we use. So, you know, who does what, who's responsible for what, and that's about the best you can do, I think, in this world where there's never going to be just one tool. We're never going to be able to standardize on one tool only.
Yeah, and as you all know, through our shared friendship with Maura and people like that, that with this whole wave of predictive coding that seems to be out there on the horizon, that the workflows are now being sort of, you know, people are having to think about them a little bit again. So there's plenty of work to be done. That's good news, right? Never stop.
Right.
So Peggy, when you're comparing vendors, when you're trying to make this analysis, being sort of the technical workflow gurus in-house in your firm, how do you compare them since they all price and measure results differently? You know, I know doctors complain about handling insurance claims. They don't have enough time to practice medicine. Do you ever feel like sometimes there's it's too hard to compare vendors?
Oh, all the time. But I try to be realistic. Vendors are never going to all use a standard pricing structure and standard measuring structures and tools. It's just, I don't think it's ever going to happen. We can come close, I think. And so, you know, we've been in this situation many times trying to compare between vendors, and we just do the best we can. We, you know, try to ask the vendors to give us their pricing in our format, and sometimes that works. Some of the other things, I mean, you can always compare the total cost. You may not be able to compare the various tasks, but the total estimated cost for a project should be something that every vendor can give you. I think, you know, it's a nuisance, but it's not a showstopper because, again, I think we have to be realistic about this. I think also by establishing a preferred vendor list and keeping that list as small as possible, you can control this in a much more efficient way. And once you've established your own preferred pricing, then that's one thing you don't need to compare for every matter. If you do, it eventually becomes a big waste of time. So I think you know, partnering with vendors and getting those things out of the way and establishing the workflow goes a long way. And measuring results is the same thing. You know, whoever is negotiating the agreement or managing the project needs to communicate with the vendor. And that could be us. That could be the client. It depends. But those kinds of things should be worked out up front so that you get the reports you need and you get them when you need them. You get QC reports. You get projection reports. You get statistical sampling reports, whatever it is that is appropriate for your project. And we work through it.
Greg, it came up in a couple of the previous answers that as much as you try to standardize and develop workflow, the clients a lot of times are coming in with their own tools, their own, you know, RFP process, things like that. What challenges does it present for you to use the client-driven or selected tools?
You know, it's if we've used them before, and I agree with with Peggy and Jessica, to standardize the workflow on any external. You know, if it's a particular vendor that you haven't used, but they have the platform you've used, that certainly helps. You know, I think the biggest challenge on that, if we're being, you know, kind of directed to use someone, is making sure that we are, you know, going to be taken care of from kind of a project management standpoint. I think that's always our biggest challenge. And when I meet with folks, you know, to a degree, the technology, great, it does this and this and this. But finding someone that we're going to be able to work with, who is going to be our project manager who's going to be our advocate, who is going to be responsive, you know, all of these particular things, who for lack of a better statement, who gets it. That's tough, because I think in a lot of situations we haven't been able to it takes a long time to develop that relationship to be able to have that, because it's relationships, it's understanding how each firm works, how things go back and forth. And I think if we're directed to work with somebody that we haven't worked with before, you know, you're kind of starting at square one, because it's all so unique.
So Jessica, sort of near at the end here, where do you see litigation support going in the future with eDiscovery? Are you seeing any trends?
Yeah. For the past couple of years, I've seen more and more of our profession shifting from law firms to clients. The clients our law firms support. In a lot of ways, their focus is moving more and more towards information governance, but they are definitely becoming more savvy regarding eDiscovery. And as they become more savvy, they're realizing that eDiscovery is really 80% process, 20% law at that. And strong eDiscovery project management is what's needed to keep costs under control and either neutralize the impact of eDiscovery or turn it into an asset for the substantive part of the case.
You know, the last question I had here, I just thought of at the end, I want to ask if you have any advice on starting a lit support department for people at firms that haven't done this before. And let's see, I'll start with you, Peggy, then Greg, and then Jessica.
Well, that's a tough one. Advice.
One of the three guests, okay.
If a firm does not have already have a litigation support department, I think I would say the first step is to get buy-in from the attorneys and before hiring, before you're buying technology, I think the first step would be to involve the firm or key people, key departments, key groups, and get the buy-in, get them excited about what you're going to be doing. Of course, you need the skills, you need the staff, you need the tools, but just set the goals and talk about them, and then meet those goals. And so I think it's, setting and meeting expectations.
Okay. Greg, I don't know if you have anything to add to that.
You know, I absolutely agree. I think that's right. And I think, also with the buy-in, to make sure that the department is seen as really a professional department, that it's that you're getting the right people and that you're not just, we'll get an IT person in or maybe we'll just promote someone with not a lot of experience and they'll learn on the job. I mean, I think we're at we're certainly at a level now where it takes someone with a very unique skill set to do this. And if you're starting a department, to certainly have that in place, and again to second what Peggy said, is to don't buy anything right off, don't do all this, but get the right people, get the buy-in, and then work on the process and the workflow, and then let it kind of go from there.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about the buy-in too much, except I've had some friends that have really strong technical backgrounds that have gone into massive law firms as sort of an experiment. Let's throw this tech person in, and it's a revolving door. Eventually the tech people get annoyed at the lawyers. They
right.
Say, I don't want to do this anymore.
Right.
So I guess buy-ins are so important.
I'm sorry. Sorry, Carl. One thing I wanted to add to what I said before, in addition to the buy-in, I think it really helps to look at a lit support department as a business. And I don't mean necessarily in terms of making it a profit center. I just mean when you are starting up a litigation support department or, running an existing one, to look at it as a business. In terms of cost effectiveness, efficiency, management, and all of the metrics, projecting future requirements, everything, and I think that also will help with the credibility and the buy-in.
Okay, and Jessica, I don't know if you have anything to add on this.
Yeah, I'm just going to go ahead and piggyback on that last comment. It's, you know, you have as a firm who doesn't have a support, you have a really great opportunity to put in lit support, especially if you take it on as a business type opportunity or looking at it and structuring it as a business early on. A lot of lit support departments really did start ad hoc, and people had to backtrack and figure that out and put it into place. But if you don't have lit support, you can really take a measured, thoughtful approach on how you put it into place.
Great. Well, I want to thank you, Jessica, Peggy, and Greg, for joining us here at ESI Bytes. It's always a pleasure to have you and speakers like you share your knowledge with us and our listeners, and hopefully we'll be able to do some more shows with you later this year. I'd also like to thank our sponsor, Juranov, for their continued support of ESI Bytes. To the listeners, if you've enjoyed the podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com for a complete list of our show. You can also remember the show and website phonetically, as it sounds out as Easy Bytes of ESI information. However you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, wishing you a nice day.